to Santiago. 562 submachine guns and ammo. Being sent by courier. Leaving Washington, 0700 hours, 19 October. Due arrive, Santiago, late evening, 20 October. The detailed plans of a political assassination. In the crosshairs was General René Schneider, chief of staff of the Chilean Armed Forces, who had made powerful enemies in Washington. The weapons for the assassination arrived in a diplomatic bag.
The U.S. administration regarded my father as an obstacle towards achieving their objectives. Consequently, he had to be eliminated, as you would an irritating insect. Only this particular insect was my father.
General Schneider gave his backing to the Chilean election results of September 1970, won by the left-wing candidate Salvador Allende. The general announced publicly that the army would respect the outcome of the election. Allende had a simple majority of 36.2% of the vote, but the Chilean Congress was required to endorse his election victory.
The election in Chile has been won, but the president has not been confirmed, the new president, Salvador Allende. Chile has, like the United States, a transition period of about 60 days. Before the president can even accept the oath of office, Henry Kissinger suborns the murder of the military officer, the senior military officer, General René Schneider, head of the Chilean General Staff, who in his person, as an individual, is thought of as the principal obstacle to a military coup, because he believes the Chilean armed forces take their oath only to the Constitution. It's therefore decided Schneider must go.
The Cold War U.S. administration saw Allende's victory as benefiting the Soviet Union and impacting upon the vital interests of America. As recently released CIA files now prove, President Nixon and his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, planned a military coup to prevent Allende from taking office. Kissinger coordinated the covert operation, of which not even the U.S. ambassador in Chile was informed.
If any adventure were undertaken, it would boomerang against the United States and personally against the president, worse than the Bay of Pigs. That was the cable that got me a summons home right away because they thought I had stumbled on their plot.
So you knew that they planned some adventure?
I smelled it as a newspaper man.
Nixon and Kissinger instructed the CIA to have General Schneider kidnapped in an attempt to trigger a military coup. The recalcitrant ambassador was summoned home to report to the president.
We were in a Cold War. It was a question of who was going to survive, Marxist-Leninist, or free world, market economies, democracies, in Chile, with the facts that it was being communized by Allende, that the women of Chile, unable to get the Chilean military because of their long heritage of non-intervention, to take action, went to the streets of Santiago and other cities. You remember they called it the Pots and Pans Brigade. Yeah. It is all forgotten today. I never hear a word written about it.
Behind Ambassador Corre's back, the CIA station in Santiago received the following orders by telex. It is firm and continuing policy that Allende be overthrown by a coup, utilizing every appropriate resource. It is imperative that these actions be implemented clandestinely and securely, so that the U.S. government and the American hand will be hidden. The U.S. administration funded the operation to the tune of $250,000, which was used to recruit members of the Chilean armed forces to liquidate their commander. Contact with the hit squad was established via mutual acquaintances in Chile's equestrian community.
I mean, they had no one that had the closest connection with the Chilean army at that time, an outsider, except me. Because, one, we never went to any American functions. We went to all Chilean functions. My wife played bridge with many of the wives and did things with them. I rode on their team as a rider.
Kissinger and Haig and Helms were discussing the idea with the kidnapping. But what was the purpose? What did they expect from a kidnapping?
Well, they'd have to bring General Pratch, who was the number two man in the army, in to become commander of the army, because he was for us.
Was Pratch for you?
Yeah.
Yeah, you speak with him?
Yeah.
What did he say? What did you ask him and what did he answer?
He just smiled and said, well, if something happened to the present commander of the army, I would then become the president of the military.
And then do a coup.
Yeah.
At this stage, General René Schneider was still unaware that a group of his own soldiers had been hired to assassinate him. The traitors received their blood money from Kissinger's courier, Colonel Weimert.
It was just the way it was. I had this money and I couldn't put it in my office safe. I took it. It was done in long rubber bands, $250,000. And I put it in my riding boots and no one else moved the boots but me.
General Camilo Valenzuela, the local commander in Santiago, was supplied with arms, hand grenades, and $50,000 in cash by Weimert. The extreme right-wing General Roberto Vio also received $50,000 and a life assurance policy worth over $250,000. Subsequently, Henry Kissinger testified before the Senate committee hearing that he gave the order on the 15th of October 1970 to abort the assassination attempt. But a telex sent from CIA headquarters to the Santiago station a day later proved the opposite. A Vio coup attempt, carried out by him alone with the forces now at his disposal, would fail. Encourage him to amplify his planning, encourage him to join forces with other coup planners so that they may act in concert.
The issue is whether Kissinger, as he claims, turned off track two on October 15th, 1970, when he met with the CIA, and the CIA informed him that the leading coup plotter at that moment, Roberto Vio, might move precipitously and that he might fail in his coup effort, and that would have grave implications for future coups as well as for the United States. And Kissinger at that point said, well, we should tell Vio to hold off, at least temporarily, tell him to preserve his assets and to work with others, and we'll get back to him. The documents about that meeting are absolutely clear. We have them here. Kissinger instructed the CIA representative, Mr. Karamasinas, to preserve agency assets in Chile, working clandestinely and securely to maintain the capability for agency operations against Allende in the future. This is the most important. The meeting concluded, and I quote, on Dr. Kissinger's note that the agency should continue keeping the pressure on every Allende weak spot in sight. Now, after the 24th of October, after the 5th of November, and into the future until such time as new marching orders are given. Mr. Karamasinas, the CIA representative, stated that the agency would comply. The document is clear. Kissinger did not turn off coup plotting. He reaffirmed the marching orders that coup plotting should continue. And in the CIA's cable from Langley headquarters to the Santiago station the next day, it is absolutely clear. Track 2 policy objectives and actions were viewed at high U.S. government level. That's a reference to the meeting with Henry Kissinger. It is firm and continuing policy that Allende be overthrown by a coup.
On that morning, my father left home at around 8 o'clock, accompanied only by his chauffeur. At the junction of Martinez Zamora, America Vespuccio, his car was forced to a halt by other vehicles. A man called Mendoza, who was waiting at the intersection, aimed a shot at my father and injured his hand. My father managed to draw his revolver and return fire. Then several men jumped out of a jeep, smashed the car windows, and fired inside.
Not assassination and not murder. That the hearing was very clear about that. It was accidental in terms of the United States.
But kidnapping is not a crime.
Well, kidnapping is. It depends on what your objectives are. I'm not going to justify it. They were not my policy.
No sé exactamente qué orden tenía.
I don't know what their orders were. But there was not the slightest attempt to kidnap my father. There was no get out of the car, you're kidnapped. They came, they fired, and they vanished.
The assassination of General Schneider ended in disaster for Kissinger. Allende emerged from the crisis in a stronger position. The army backed his election victory, as did the opposition Christian Democratic Party.
Did you go to Schneider's funeral?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, as we know, one of my horses were used in a parade for the funeral.
Kissinger said to the Senate committee, "There was no plot I am familiar with. I never ordered it. I was not involved."
You are.
After the successful execution of the operation, U.S. government paid the hit squad hush money. In an effort to keep the prior contact secret, maintain the goodwill of the group, and for humanitarian reasons, $35,000 was passed. On the 11th of September 1973, Salvador Allende died in the burning presidential palace, the Moneda. And the generals effected their military coup at the behest of conservative politicians and the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, who were keen to see the army restore law and order on the streets. But the leader of the junta, Augusto Pinochet, had grander plans, a self-styled, ruthless military dictatorship.
That's like having ants in your cellar. You gotta kill them, get rid of them. And they had a lot of bad people there at that time. I mean, he did, if I'd have been in his place, I'd have done the same thing. He had to clean it out. And a lot of people got killed. But a lot of people got killed, I felt, deserved being killed.
Hundreds of suspects were executed, thousands more tortured and incarcerated in concentration camps. 1,500 people disappeared without trace. Within a few weeks, Chile's parliamentary democracy was destroyed. Yet Henry Kissinger remained silent.
Kissinger had many intelligence reports on the atrocities taking place under Augusto Pinochet, atrocities that reached their peak in 1975 and 1976. And yet, in June of 1976, Kissinger traveled to Chile to give a speech, ironically, on human rights at the Organization of American States meeting that was being held in Santiago. And he did a curious thing. He quietly met with Augusto Pinochet before he gave this speech. In his memoirs, he portrays this meeting as going to tell Pinochet that you have to do something about your human rights record. But the actual transcript of the meeting, which was declassified not so long ago, makes it clear that his memoirs totally misrepresent what actually happened and his own goal in meeting with General Pinochet. What he really told Pinochet is, look, I have to give this speech about human rights violations in Chile because the U.S. Congress needs to be mollified. I need to please them. Otherwise, they're going to cut off economic and military aid to Chile, and that won't be in your interest or in my interest. I want you to know, he told Pinochet, that in the West, we are grateful that you overthrew Allende. We believe you did a great service to the West.
Here, at the site of the former Pisagua concentration camp, bodies of regime opponents were excavated.
General, do you still claim that no one disappeared?
Señorita, that was a secret war, planned by the KGB.
Several bodies were found in one grave.
How practical. In June 2001, Henry Kissinger unveiled his book, Does America Need a Foreign Policy? The world-renowned politician continued to shroud in silence the darker chapters of his biography. He refused to grant this film an interview, arguing that he did not want to confirm conclusions which have no basis in fact. What drove this once liberal and brilliant Harvard professor to back one of the most brutal dictators of the 20th century? Henry Kissinger was himself a survivor of a dictatorship. Born of Jewish parentage in the Bavarian town of Fürth in 1923, Heinz Alfred Kissinger was just 15 when in 1938 his family fled from Hitler's fascism and emigrated to America. Kissinger's liberal friends and students at Harvard University were surprised when in 1968 their mentor entered the service of Richard Nixon, the bête noire of the liberal establishment. Kissinger was eager to take up a new challenge. The Vietnam War provided him with the ideal opportunity. During Vietnam's Tet celebrations to mark the beginning of the Lunar New Year in 1968, a Viet Cong commando unit stormed the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. The attack was repelled, but the images of an impotent superpower endured. The U.S. establishment finally accepted that the war could not be won. Acting on the conclusions of a CIA analysis revealing that 80% of the rural population of South Vietnam supported the Viet Cong, President Johnson announced a halt to the bombing shortly before the presidential elections in 1968. The peace negotiations in Paris were on the brink of a dramatic breakthrough.
Tonight, I have ordered our aircraft and our naval vessels to make no attacks on North Vietnam.
prospects of peace boosted Vice President Hubert Humphrey's standing in the polls, causing panic in the camp of his Republican opponent, Richard Nixon. Nixon arranged a secret meeting with the Chinese businesswoman, Anna Chenault, who lived in the Watergate apartment complex. He asked her to persuade the South Vietnamese president, too, to sabotage the peace plan.
But then when Johnson announced this big announcement, it concerned them. And knowing that I travel to Asia quite frequently, and I talk to my friends in Southeast Asia very frequently, and President Chu also did not trust even his ambassador to Washington, D.C. And so he sent special representative to Washington to see me and give me messages, because he did not want to have any contact with Nixon directly. So messages from South Vietnam always gone through me. Mm. And I indirectly, and then I would give it to
but
Mitchell.
What has been the last message of Nixon, Mitchell to Chu, President Chu? After the Johnson speak,
want to know if he still not go to Paris peace talk.
Did they urge him not to go?
No, they did not. And they did not, I mean, they didn't go that far, but they want to know what was his position. And I got back the information from President Chu that he would not, he would take the chance, he would not go to Paris peace talk until the election.
The FBI placed Anna Chenault under surveillance. A few days later, an intelligence agent reported that she had asked President Tu to boycott the Paris negotiations. On behalf of Richard Nixon, she told him, "Hold on, we're gonna win." In his memoirs, Nixon later confessed to having had an informant in Johnson's delegation at the Paris peace talks, who was feeding him information on the president's policy. His name? Henry Kissinger.
We did know that he was getting information from both sides. He probably was giving information to both sides too. And I don't blame him. I mean, after all, he was not sure which side's going to win. Whoever wins, he's going to go to their side. That's all right with me.
Nixon's secret diplomacy proved successful. 2 days before the election, Tu boycotted the Paris negotiations. Nixon won the election by a very narrow majority, thanks to the active support of Anna Chenault and Henry Kissinger.
He did agree to use his position of trust and confidence in Paris to funnel quite important advance information, in particular on the crucial matter of the timing of the bombing halt, as it was known in the campaign, the decision to cease the bombardment of North Vietnam. In other words, Mr. Nixon always knew in advance the moves of the government he was running against. And we know further that Mr. Kissinger's opinion of Mr. Nixon was very low. He had always and repeatedly and quite indiscreetly said to people in the Rockefeller Republican camp and also to his Democratic friends like Mr. Brzezinski, Professor Huntington, that he regarded Nixon as a dangerous crook, as an unscrupulous man, as a political fanatic. So why is he suddenly doing this tremendous favor during an election campaign to someone for whom he has nothing but contempt?
Why?
It's in the hope of a political reward.
President-elect and I have had many extensive conversations over the past week about the problems and opportunities confronting the United States and the international field.
Kissinger succeeded in maneuvering himself to the very heart of power in the U.S. Nixon appointed him as security advisor, as president of the National Security Council, as director of the 40 Committee, which coordinated the covert operations of the U.S. intelligence services, and as head of the study group Vietnam, which was responsible for the daily execution of the war. In effect, Kissinger was running a kind of undercover U.S. government.
When I talked to Nixon, he made the commitment that if he wanted presidency, he would try every way to end the war in Vietnam. And that's why I went out of my way to help him. But after the elections, he wanted to have to end the war with victory, which I consider was not possible. Kissinger didn't quite agree with me either, because I think he was the one who convinced Nixon that they could end the war with victory. And I didn't see how we could win the war in victory. And I saw United States getting deeper and deeper into this Vietnam conflict.
Kissinger was striving for outright victory as the only way to ensure an honorable peace. The first 6 months of 1969 saw the introduction of a new strategy of pacification. Launched in the Kien Ho province of the Mekong Delta to purge the delta of Viet Cong, Operation Speedy Express involved the use of massive firepower. Conducted on the express orders from the highest echelons of the administration, this operation precipitated a massacre witnessed by American citizens.
In those 6 months, the Army reported killing approximately 11,000 enemy soldiers. The number was, I believe, 10,899 or something, close to 11,000. The number of weapons captured from those dead people, called enemy, in the press release was very specific. It was 748 weapons. It's suggested that most of the people killed, as it turned out, had no weapons, and in fact they were civilians. And many of the people killed, possibly 5,000, at least 5,000, were innocent civilians killed quite deliberately. I mean, the command had no they were aware of the inevitability of putting that much firepower into densely populated areas. Relentless airstrikes, B-52 strikes, tactical airstrikes, helicopter gunships crisscrossing the area, shooting. Under the terms they were under, they could shoot at practically anything that moved. And we went to civilian hospitals to find out what had happened. Their records were vivid. At one civilian hospital after another, we found that the people admitted during that time were killed or wounded, died in the hospital, but had been sent there by what was known as friendly fire, which was U.S. fire. Very small percentage of hospital admissions of civilians came from Viet Cong fire. The command liked this operation so much, the results of it, that they sent people from other parts of the country down there to see what had happened so that it could be duplicated elsewhere. And the study, the managerial study, as it were, of Speedy Express involved determining, the Pentagon term was peak killing hour. That is the time when all systems were going, and it speaks for itself, peak killing hour. And that hour, this general told me, had been ascertained to be late afternoon, about 4 or so, a time that anybody in Vietnam knew. There was a lot of civilian traffic out there, kids coming home from school, people coming home from work. Right on the village, that concussion shook their babies to death. They bled to death through their ears. So there wasn't much interest in, there was interest in gaining control of territory, and that's what happened. In fact, there were 120,000 Vietnamese went from enemy control under government control. In most cases, that meant, in the expression of the time, voting with their feet. It was a cruel description of what really happened, which meant they fled, because to stay in the countryside would mean they got killed.
I would have been far more vigorous in the conduct of that war. I would have ended it in the first 6 months of the Nixon presidency, which it could have been ended very easily. Oh. Not by surrender, not by overthrowing President Chu, which was what was all the Paris peace talks were all about, and not by halting bombing for dishonest promises from an enemy that had no intention of doing anything but winning, with the support and a very active support of the Soviet Union. So this was the issue, of course.
But how would you have ended the war?
Well, we could have ended the war by the Christmas bombing.
After only a few weeks in office, Henry Kissinger had become the principal architect of the war and was involved in detailed decisions at the supreme command level. He was clearly aware of the enormous casualty toll among the civilian population. In the spring of 1969, and against the advice of the Pentagon and the State Department, Nixon and Kissinger decided to expand the war to include neutral Cambodia. Their orders: to conduct massive airstrikes against the supply dumps in the border areas. Codenamed Menu, the operation was launched covertly. Congress was deliberately hoodwinked and fed false information. After the first wave of strikes, named Operation Breakfast, Nixon's chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, made the following entry in his personal diary on the 18th of March, 1969. Kissinger's Operation Breakfast, a great success. He came in beaming with the report. Very productive. Later, Haldeman wrote that Kissinger had spoken out vehemently against Nixon's proposal to end the war in 1971 for fear of damaging their chances in the forthcoming elections. For reasons of domestic policy, the war would have to be prolonged until autumn 1972.
If you ever felt that foreign policy was being manipulated for the sake of domestic political reasons, what would you do?
I would resign. And I would say so publicly. Foreign policy has to reflect the continuing values of the American people, and it cannot be the subject of partisan policy.
Even Kissinger's closest advisors on the National Security Council criticized his aggressive war policy, and consequently had their conversations tapped by the FBI.
I was one of the people who was wiretapped while serving under him. I cannot forgive him for being a party to it or for never apologizing.
Why did he do that? Had he reasons to suspect that you gave information?
No, I mean, you look at the people who wiretapped, it had nothing to do with information. I think it was intended to prove his loyalty. Nixon is recorded on the tapes, the Nixon tapes, as saying, all we got was gossip and bullshit.
But how do you explain, because you were friends with him, how can you explain such a change in his attitude and his personal development?
I think he was willing to do anything necessary to retain power.
He wiretapped aides and associates in the Pentagon. He wiretapped American journalists with whom he had supposedly friendly and close relations. This was part of this atmosphere of paranoia and almost hysteria inside the administration about leaks to the press, about what they regarded as acts of not just disloyalty, but downright treason. And Henry was very ardent in pursuing the traitors, as they were seen by the inner guard, the inner circle of the Nixon White House, to establish, of course, his own bona fides, to establish his own credibility with Nixon, with Haldeman, with Ehrlichman. But the taps, in the end, were all part of this this ceaseless maneuvering for power. They never yielded any important or substantive information about leaks, and everyone knew that. But they were a sign of Henry's devotion.
Vietnam veterans staged anti-war protests in front of Capitol Hill and handed back their medals. The protest movement was directed primarily against the use of indiscriminate weapons like napalm and cluster bombs against the civilian population, which they regarded as a war crime. The facts bear this out. Of the 3 million Vietnamese who were killed in the course of the war, 2 million were civilians.
I never heard Henry Kissinger express the slightest concern for civilian casualties or for the damage done. Quite the contrary. He began in the fall of 1969 in September in a group that's been written about called the September Group to plan a savage, brutal blow against North Vietnam, which
these
later...
These were his words?
These were his words. He said to us as a planning group, I can't believe that a fourth-rate power like North Vietnam does not have a breaking point.
Despite the application of the latest sophisticated technology, the war could not be won on the ground. The Viet Cong ruled the jungle and generally remained invisible. Their supplies came from communist North Vietnam along the hidden Ho Chi Minh Trail. The USA began withdrawing its own troops and stepping up airstrikes. The Viet Cong relocated a number of its bases to neighboring Cambodia. On the 1st of May 1970, both American and South Vietnamese soldiers launched their incursion into Cambodia to try and cut off the Viet Cong supply lines. The invasion plunged the country into a catastrophic civil war, which ultimately paved the way to power for the murderous Khmer Rouge regime.
I decided to resign, along with Tony Lake and with Bill Watts, our colleague on the NSC staff, because I felt that the Cambodian invasion was a betrayal of the president's pledge to seek an honorable and just peace in Vietnam. I knew that peace was within our grasp. I was intimately involved in the negotiations. I knew that the other side was ready to agree, that we were ready to agree, and that the Cambodian invasion really destroyed all of that, devastated it for years to come. And literally cost tens of thousands of American lives, hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese lives. I thought it was one of the great crimes of the century.
Those who disagreed with the wisdom of the decision, and those for whom the decision provided a catharsis, and which then led them into an attack on the whole structure of government, the credibility of the presidency, and the authority of our leadership. The former was understandable. Because it was a tough problem, and the pros and cons were fairly evenly divided. The second is a tragic national problem, because if confidence in our leadership is destroyed, that is not a partisan problem. That goes to the heart of the issues we face with the whole younger generation. And with confidence destroyed, every political issue turns into a test of strength, into a test of physical strength on the streets or in demonstrations or in some other way.
The Christmas of 1972 saw a final brutal strike launched against the populations of Hanoi and Haiphong. 3,000 bombing raids in 10 days. The last act of a humiliated superpower. An attack that was superfluous since the ceasefire agreement had already been finalized and was ready for signing.
I'm appalled by things like the Christmas bombing of Hanoi, which is certainly the only time that we have bombed an enemy for the purpose of bringing an ally along with us. It got the terms that we were offered before and after the Christmas bombing were basically unchanged.
The USA had only escalated the war in order to secure a better bargaining position at the negotiating table in Paris. Unable to persuade the chief negotiator of the North Vietnamese delegation, Le Duc Tho, to agree to any compromises, Kissinger finally had to accept the complete withdrawal of U.S. forces.
I personally felt that Kissinger winning the Nobel Peace Prize, or half a peace prize, to be technical about it, was the absolute low point in the award of the Peace Prize. I thought it was an absolute mockery of the intentions of Nobel. This was a man who had not just pursued the peace negotiations for his own purposes and in a very cynical and hypocritical way. This was a man who had prolonged the war by the decisions that he made and joined in, who had covered up some of the worst atrocities of the American policy in Southeast Asia, who had really, in many ways, been the principal architect of the American war policy.
The leading North Vietnamese politician, Le Duc Tho, declined to accept the Nobel Peace Prize. Henry Kissinger, however, had no such inhibitions.
When I shall receive the award, together with my old colleague in the search for peace in Vietnam, Mr. Le Duc Tho, I hope that that occasion will at last mark the end, or symbolize the end, of the anguish and the suffering that Vietnam has meant for so many millions of people around the world.
As North Vietnamese tanks headed towards Saigon, the war continued unabated. But the support for the beleaguered II regime in Saigon promised by Kissinger failed to arrive. The American Congress blocked the necessary funds.
That same period between the peace treaty and the end of the conflict, where we surrendered, in effect, we withdrew with our tails between our legs, the American Congress cut, so that the South Vietnamese forces didn't even have grenades to throw at the enemy.
Chaos erupted as the last Americans fled Vietnam. In desperation, supporters of the two governments attempted to get into the embassy grounds and secure a flight to safety. On the 1st of May 1975, a division of the North Vietnamese Army took Saigon and occupied the presidential palace. The country was reunified.
I should think that the way in which the American war in Indochina ended would be on anybody's list of the top 10 disasters of history.
And that he got the Nobel.
It's the most celebrated calamity, you know, in American history at any rate. The same is true of the Cyprus imbroglio. A disaster, no winners, all losers. Bangladesh, disaster. Chile, a nightmare. East Timor, people don't even want to think about it. This is not real politics. It's criminal politics.
The Vietnam Memorial in Washington bears the names of the 58,000 soldiers who fell in battle. As the principal architect of the Vietnam War, will Kissinger ever be forced to answer personally for his deeds? Or do the conventions on war crimes apply only to history's vanquished leaders, like Goering, Pinochet, and Milosevic?
My own view is that if we held Henry Kissinger to the standards we have begun to hold other leaders, other policymakers in other societies, and the standards to which we held policymakers in Germany and in Japan after World War II, that yes, he runs the very considerable risk of ending as a convicted war criminal.
The graves of Pinochet's victims in Santiago. Their families and relatives are calling for justice and an investigation to establish what the U.S. government knew about the massacres and political assassinations. Perhaps only Pinochet's trial could determine if Henry Kissinger was not just an accessory to these crimes, but a willing accomplice. The author, Christopher Hitchens, is convinced of this.
I think he's individually responsible as well as collectively responsible for murder, for kidnapping, for torture. And I think he's derived obscene enjoyment from this role in his life. I think he looks back on it with relish. And I would like to see him in the dock answering questions. And yes, that would certainly meet anyone's definition of destruction, because this is a man who is a coward and has always been able to hide behind the state when these terrible matters come up. And to see him have to face it on his own would be, yes, it would probably be lethal for him.
Vietnam veterans still demonstrate in Washington, D.C., protesting against the fact that they're not recognized as national heroes, as were the soldiers of the Second World War, but remain tainted by the war crimes committed in Vietnam, unlike their political masters.
Shocking myths of the Great War, that of the Allied soldier crucified by the Germans. We sort out the facts in just a moment.